Father's Day is next Sunday, so I thought it would be as appropriate a time as ever to talk to you about manliness. And I think this is an important topic for several reasons. Ladies, don't close your ears. It's an important topic for you because this is something that you need to instill in your sons, encourage in your brothers in Christ, and expect in your husbands. And men, it's an important topic to you because our culture tells us a lot of lies about manliness, about what manliness looks like. And I hate to talk about the media or our culture as something other and to kind of project, you know, an image of fear about that, because our culture is me and you, it's us. And so we need to think about how we conceive of manliness and not allow ourselves to buy into lies about it, buy into popular ideas about it. So the title of tonight's lesson is Looking Up Manliness in God's Dictionary. What does God think of manliness? And to be clear to almost everybody in the room, that that's the standard that we're being held to. And so that's what we need to understand. That should be what informs our definition of manliness. A few reasons I think this is important. One, as I've already mentioned, and as we'll see in a second, popular ideas about manliness don't always gel with God's definition. In popular culture, a lot of what we see is that religion is considered to be kind of a woman's thing, or the woman can go to church and she can take the kids, and the man will just, you know, stay at home and watch football or go to the lake or play golf, something like that. It's also important because when we think about men that we're trying to bring into the church, you know, we're studying with someone, you know, perhaps he's a friend, or ladies, you know, if you're trying to convert a boyfriend, a fiancé, a husband, it's important that he know that God has an idea, an expectation, a standard of what a godly man looks like that doesn't have to be effeminate, doesn't have to be soft. Most churches I go to are majority women, you know, 60%. I've seen it as high as two-thirds women in our churches, and there's a reason for that. I think there are several reasons for that. I think part of it has to do with the way that we talk about values. And, you know, we often emphasize things like, you know, meekness and patience, but there's a place for that, certainly. But there's also a place for strength, for godly manhood, and for godly service and leadership. And I know George agrees on that. I know there's been a lot of sound teaching on leadership in this church. So we're not going to focus on leadership as much per se, but to get an idea of what a godly man looks like. So let's start with some popular ideas out in the world about what makes someone manly. And I didn't just come up with these. I was having a discussion with a bunch of 20 and 30-year-old Christian men in January at a study we were doing, and I said, just what ideas do you get from the world around you about what's considered manly? And some of the things they brought up were smoking. You can see the picture of Sean Connery there as James Bond with a cigarette. You know, that used to be commonplace in movies. Drinking, you know, being able to drink a lot, the ability to hold your liquor is something that's often considered manly in the world. Violence and bravado, you know, often considered manly. You can see the picture of John Wayne there with a gun. You know, he's one of the manliest figures I know in popular culture. And I'm not saying don't watch these movies. They're enjoyable, and this is, you know, this is something that can be fun to watch, but don't let this be what dictates your idea of what makes someone manly. A lot of what's portrayed as manly is self-interest, a guy who's only looking out for himself, or maybe for his buddies. Men who make sacrifices for their wives, for their children, for service to God, often aren't portrayed or aren't elevated or exalted in popular culture. In fact, a lot of sitcoms that I see portray the husband as just some dunce, and the wife's the one that's holding it all together. And not to diminish the role of women in any way, but the man needs to be a partner, a figure in that, and a leader in the household. And so, men, we need to not buy into these ideas or let them be our only idea of what manliness is. Also, this idea of reputation goes along with it. A lot of guys, that's you know, that's what they're interested in cultivating, is having a good reputation. You know, it's maybe a guy who gets a lot of women, or a guy who's very macho, things like that. If you see, though, manliness according to God's word is something different. And I'm not saying that it has to be something effeminate. It has to be something weak. Just the opposite. Turn to 1 Corinthians 16. And I think you'll see there why having a biblical understanding of manliness is so important. Right there in the middle of 1 Corinthians 16:13, I'm reading the English Standard Version, and I understand that other versions will translate this a little bit differently, but I think this gets at the right idea here. Right in the middle of 1 Corinthians 16:13, it says, "Act like men." Paul, writing to the Corinthians, says, "Act like men." Other versions say, you know, maybe be courageous or put a little bit different spin on it. But let's read through all of verses 13 and 14, and that'll kind of form the outline of today's lesson. It says, "Be watchful, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, and then let all that you do be done in love." And so those points will be the basis of our lesson today. A godly man is watchful. A godly man is firm in his faith. He's not wishy-washy about it. A godly man knows when to take action. A godly man is strong. Jesus was strong. Peter was strong. Peter and John, as we learned about this morning in class, were fishermen. You know, they had to be able to haul in those nets. Peter knew how to wield a sword, not always with the utmost accuracy. But Jesus, you know, we emphasize a lot of characteristics of Jesus, but we don't often think about the Jesus who flipped tables and who braided a whip and defended his father's house. There's an element of strength to being a godly man. And also, a godly man is loving. And that I think that it goes almost without saying, but since it's right here, I think it offers good balance to some of these other traits, but it doesn't negate any of them. Being a loving man doesn't mean you give up your strength, doesn't mean you give up your manhood. So, the point of being watchful, let's look at 1 Chronicles 12. A lot of good examples of manliness in this chapter. This is David's mighty men, describing them. And some of these are even traits of manliness that our culture would readily recognize. Don't worry, we won't read the whole chapter, but let's just kind of skim through and get an idea of the manliness of some of these individuals. 1 Chronicles 12, verse 2 says, "They were bowmen and could shoot arrows and sling stones with either the right hand or the left hand." Verse 8, "From the Gadites there went over to David at the stronghold in the wilderness mighty and experienced warriors, expert with shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions and who were swift as gazelles upon the mountains." Verse 15, "These are the men who crossed the Jordan in the first month when it was overflowing its banks and put to flight all those in the valleys to the east and to the west." Verse 21, "They helped David against the band of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor and were commanders in the army." Verse 24, "The men of Judah bearing shield and spear were 6,800 armed troops. Of the Simeonites, mighty men of valor for war, 7,100. Of the Levites, 4,600. The prince of Jehoiada of the house of Aaron, and with him 3,700. Zadok, a young man mighty in valor, and 22 commanders from his own father's house. Of the Benjamites, the kinsmen of Saul, 3,000, of whom the majority had to that point kept their allegiance to the house of Saul. Of the Ephraimites, 20,800 mighty men of valor, famous in their father's houses. Of the half-tribe of Manasseh, 18,000, who were expressly named to come and make David king." And then after all of these thousands and thousands that fit with our pretty conventional picture of what manliness is, look then in verse 32. "Of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen under their command." So here we have people who are mighty warriors. We have weapons experts. We have men whose faces were like lions. Their beards were so thick, it looked like a lion's mane. We have men who are swift as gazelles. Being on the hills or the mountains didn't deter them from chasing their enemies. Then we have men who know that it's time for David to become king. We have men who had understanding of the times. But after all those thousands and thousands that are named as mighty warriors, it says 200 chiefs of Israel knew what time it was. Men who had understanding of the times. A godly man can develop all those characteristics, can grow a mighty beard, but an important characteristic for a godly man to have is to have an understanding of the times, to know what time it is, to know when it's time to act, to serve the will of God. And these were men who realized that God's hand had gone from Saul and that it was time to come and make David king, and they were willing to fight to do it. So having an understanding of the times is an important characteristic. To do that, you need to be watchful. You need to know what's going on in the world around you. What's going on in your kids' lives? What are they learning at school? What are they watching on television? What's going on in your wife's life? Ask her how her day was. And by getting to know the people around you, you know, get to know people in this congregation. Get to know them, see what's going on in their lives, and that's how you'll know when to step in, how to serve, how to be a godly man in their lives. Something that I would encourage men here to do, if there are any single mothers who are raising sons, you know, ask them if they might like you to, you know, take their son for a day, play ball with them, take him to a game, take him to a museum, take him to do whatever he likes to do. You know, be a godly example to all of the young men in this church. You know, not just your own sons, not just your own grandsons. Be a godly example to everyone, and be watchful. Know what the threats are against this family here. Also, be firm in faith. That's important. A good example of that, I think, comes from Daniel. We'll have a couple examples from Daniel, actually, but this one in chapter 1. Daniel here, certainly an individual firm in his faith. Let's read verses 8 through 16. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age, so you would endanger my head with the king? Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So he listened to them in this manner and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Am I saying that you have to become a vegetarian to be a godly man? No. But we did talk about self-control this morning. And I think Daniel here is exhibiting self-control. He's refraining from something that he could have done. And he's firm in his faith. He's willing to be tested for what he did. And I know people who, you know, who fast or who maybe refrain from eating meat for a certain period of time. And I think that displays a great amount of self-control to be able to do that. And I think self-control and firmness in faith go hand in hand as something a godly man should cultivate. It's important to notice here that Daniel and his friends were youths. These were young men. And I think it should be clear to us that God's expectation of us as far as manliness doesn't start when we hit a certain age. You know, doesn't start when you hit 21. It's like, okay, now it's time to be a godly man. Doesn't start when you hit 30. You can't say, oh, now it's time to be a godly man. It's not a switch that you can flip on or off. Now, in Jewish culture, they set that age at 13. And that's, you know, when they have the bar mitzvah and all of that. But I'm not suggesting that we need to set any arbitrary age, but that, you know, this is something that you can't just put off and put off and put off and think, you know, oh, I'll become a godly man when I hit X age, or when I get married, or when I have kids. If you keep putting it off and putting it off, you'll never find a reason to start. The best time to start cultivating godly manliness or godly womanliness, if you're a woman, is right now. And no matter what age, you can start cultivating these characteristics and take responsibilities that are appropriate, whatever your age may be. Also, they were far from home. Godly manliness doesn't worry about who's watching. It's not about, you know, whether your boss at work has his eye on you or not, as to whether you're a hard worker. It's not about whether your wife is watching over your shoulder as to whether you're going to be a good parent or husband or not. Godly manliness is just that. It's living up to the standard of God and knowing that he's always watching and always trying to be the kind of man that God wants you to be. They resolve not to defile themselves. And godly manliness, firmness in faith, means taking stands like this. It doesn't have to be, you know, what you, you know, whether or not you're going to eat meat, but whenever you feel challenged in your faith, take a stand. And Daniel asked respectfully. It wasn't about being, you know, being flippant or being disrespectful or being rude or proving his macho characteristics to do this. He asked the steward respectfully. He said, "Can we do this?" And he was willing to be tested. He said, "I'm asking you if you can do this. This is a stand that I'm going to take, and test us on it. You know, test us for 10 days. Godly men are willing to be tested. When they put their faith on the line, they know that they're going to be tested. That people are watching, that people care about how you react to certain situations, and people are watching your behavior. Another example from Daniel in chapter 6. So as we read in 1 Corinthians 16, it said, stand firm in the faith, act like men. It's not, well, it started with be watchful, and then it said stand firm in the faith, and then it said act like men. And I kind of picture this as someone who's sitting, standing, walking. You know, this is a process of developing these characteristics. But godly manhood isn't just standing back waiting to see what happens. It's being on the offensive for God, trying to win the battle against evil, against Satan, against all the things that would weigh us down and prevent us from serving God. Daniel was a man of action, as we see in chapter 6. I'll read verses 3 through 13. So this is much later in Daniel's life, kind of fast forward to when he's become a prominent official. Then this Daniel became distinguished above all the other presidents and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. So he was a spiritual man. And the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So he had a lot of responsibilities. Then the presidents and the satraps sought to find a ground for complaint against Daniel with regard to the kingdom, but they could find no ground for complaint or any fault, because he was faithful, and no error or fault was found in him. Then these men said, "We shall not find any ground for complaint against this Daniel unless we find it in connection with the law of his God." Then these presidents and satraps came by agreement to the king and said to him, "O King Darius, live forever. All the presidents of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the counselors and the governors, are agreed that the king should establish an ordinance and enforce an injunction that whoever makes petition to any god or man for 30 days, except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked." Therefore, King Darius signed the document and injunction. When Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house, where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as he had done previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and plea before his God. And they came near and said before the king concerning the injunction, "O king, did you not sign an injunction that anyone who makes petition to any god or man within 30 days except to you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions?" The king answered and said, "The thing stands fast according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be revoked." Then they answered and said before the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or the injunction you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day." So Darius here kind of offers a good counterpart to a godly man. You know, he gave in to flattery. He passed this law without thinking. He did all the kinds of things a godly man shouldn't do. You shouldn't bow to flattery. You should think about actions before you take them. But Daniel here we see as a man of action who's not going to stop, even for 30 days. He's going to continue praying to his God. He's a mature man here. He's, you know, been very elevated in the kingdom, has a lot of responsibility because he's a distinguished worker. They basically say, "We're not going to be able to find any fault in Daniel unless it has to do with his religion." Do people at your workplace say that about you? Do they know that there's not going to be any fault in you or no way to trip you up unless it comes to your religion? They might. And they might try to do things like make you work on Sunday or try to trip you up with different questions or try to get you in hot water because you're a Christian. Thankfully, I don't think that happens a lot in our land, but it does happen sometimes. And so be on the defense if you realize it's happening and try to make the right decision. He was a trustworthy man. That's why he was given all of this responsibility. And he was a prayerful man. Being a godly man doesn't mean that you have to be bad at your job. In fact, it should make you work that much harder. Because it says, we work not as for men, but for the Lord. You should be known as a hard worker, but also be known as a prayerful man. Take time in your workday to pray. Daniel, it says here, prayed 3 times a day. And I don't think we have any set number of times we should do it, but let it be known that you're a man of prayer, a man of faith. When you go to work tomorrow and people ask you, what did you do over the weekend? Tell them, that you went to church, what you did with your family. Let it be known that you're that kind of man. Daniel was also thankful to God. Look at the way that it describes his prayers. Verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document had been signed, he went to his house where he had windows in his upper chamber open toward Jerusalem. He got down on his knees 3 times a day and prayed and gave thanks before his God as he had done previously. So this was something that he made a habit, and he also had a very focused way of doing it. He made sure there were going to be no interruptions. He also had he was focused on Jerusalem. They were in exile here, and I imagine that a lot of Daniel's prayers had to do with the return to Jerusalem. And so, men, I would encourage you to be thoughtful in the public prayers that you lead, and also lead prayers out loud for your family, because we don't really have a lot of examples of how to pray. I'm not being clear here, but basically we don't we learn how to pray by hearing others pray. And so the way that you pray, the example that you set of prayer in your home and here in public worship will mean a lot to people, and it will inform the way that they pray. And so I'd encourage you to give thought to that and maybe lead more prayers out loud in your home. Not just over meals, but maybe with your kids before they go to bed or before they go to school in the morning, or whatever's appropriate for your family. But lead prayers out loud. Let your children hear you pray, and let them see the kind of things that you focus on in your prayers. And certainly, let those prayers include expressions of thanks to God. The other trait we're going to look at is that godly men are strong. I think we have a great example of that in 1 Chronicles 19. Another battle scene. A lot of these come from the Old Testament, but we'll talk about some New Testament applications of this in a moment as well. 1 Chronicles 19, 10 through 15. And what we have here is Joab and his men. They're fighting the Ammonites and the Syrians. And really, the important part that I want you to notice is verses 12 and 13. Joab says to his men, "If the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will help you. Be strong. Let us use our strength for our people and for the cities of our God, and may the Lord do what seems good to him." So a godly man, in cultivating strength, it's not about his self-interest. It's not about being able to do all the things that he wants to do. It's about being able to serve others. Joab here prays to be strong for his men, who he wants to be strong for their people, for the cities of God, and for the Lord's will. So their strength was not something they were using to serve themselves. And Romans 15:1 gives us a good advice about this. Romans 15:1, "We who are strong have an obligation to bear with the failings of the weak and not to please ourselves." I've been sort of babysitting my nephew this week, and he's not quite at the toddler stage, but I want him to start walking, and I'll hold both of his hands and let him kind of walk while I'm holding his hands and balancing him. But when I'm doing that, I can only go as fast as he's going. It's not going to do any good if I am walking fast and dragging him along. He's not going to grow. And the same way in our churches, we're described as a flock or as a family. A flock of sheep can only move as fast as the slowest sheep. You know, it's not going to do any good if all the strong sheep are way up ahead and the shepherd's back with the slow sheep, you know, trying to drag them along. We need to move as a unit, move as a body. And so those of us who are strong shouldn't be, you know, rushing off and leaving the weak behind. We should be encouraging them, trying to strengthen them so that we can all move as a unit and work together. Same way in a family, you know, when you have children, your travel slows down quite a bit. But, you know, working as a unit, bearing with the weak, and sticking together, using your strength for their good. And then the last point, a godly man should be loving. Turn to John chapter 15. We have one of Jesus' final prayers on earth. And he emphasizes love. John 15, beginning in verse 7. But let's notice what kind of love this is. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you, and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. And so this godly, manly love that we're reading about here, it means abiding in the Word. It means bearing fruit. You know, let your love be shown through your actions. Guys are often better at that than saying, you know, I love you. So if the way that you show love is through your actions, show it. Act like you love people. Obey God's command. That's the most loving thing that you can do for your spouse, for your family, is to be a godly man. Be obedient to the commandments. Set an example for them of obedience to God. And raise your children in a godly home. Sometimes this will mean making sacrifices, as I'm sure every husband or father in here knows. Jesus said in verse 13, greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. Sacrificial love is the truest love of all. You need to be able to give love, but also, guys, we need to be able to receive love. You don't have to be rough and tough and gruff all of the time. You know, if your children come up to you and say they love you, if your wife says you love her, let her know she loves you. Let her know that you appreciate that. Let your kids know that you love them, but also, it can be hard for us sometimes as guys to know how to properly receive love. And we just want to, you know, shrug it off or act like we don't need it. But it's important that that people see us as people who are both able to give and to receive love from others, and that we appreciate that. And let them know that they are needed. You know, being a man doesn't mean that you don't need anybody. It doesn't mean that you're all self-sufficient. And especially being a godly man, they should know that you need God, that you need his love, and that his love got you to where you are today. As we close, I just want to focus on those last two verses that we read a little bit more. Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. Jesus exemplified that kind of love better than any of us could do. He was the godliest man there could be. He was a perfect man, a sinless sacrifice. And if we're his friends, if we obey his commands, then his life is laid down for us, and he will bear with us in our failings, he will cover our sins, and he will help us all to grow to be more godly individuals. If you want that kind of life, if you want to be a more godly person, please don't wait. Come forward as we stand and sing.